You are listening to My Art Broker Talks. My Art Broker connects buyers and sellers of blue chip prints and editions, specializing in original prints and multiples, in particular pop, contemporary, and urban art. Hosted by Charlotte Stewart.
On today's podcast, we have Anthony Maguire from New Street, a company that brings together data and media in the physical and digital collectibles market space. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, Charlotte. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And New Street has always been on my radar, just in terms of positioning data and talking about the collectibles market and collect tech, as seems to have been this new term that's been coined by a lot of us in this marketplace. Can you start by giving our listeners just a little bit of a background about New Street and why it exists?
Yeah, totally. I think it might be best for me to start with the personal story of Eric, who's the founder. So Eric Witchin is a long-term financial technologist, had most of his career decades at Bloomberg, Benzinga, a startup that gave data, like help hedge funds process data. And at the same time, Eric has always been a collector. So from like childhood, he was collecting baseball cards. He's a big fan of art. He's a big fan of sneakers. And when COVID hit, we noticed, particularly from Eric's personal situation, that people started trading, buying, and collecting more of these things. You know, sports cards started becoming like very popular again. Pokemon cards started becoming a really big thing. And of course, NFTs became really big. And at that time, Eric tried just on his own, buying some cards, trying to get a good price on them, figuring out, okay, so I'm a big fan of this baseball player. Where do I actually buy his cards? And the reality was, is that it was a lot more difficult than he ever anticipated. And this is a guy who worked like in fintech and finance for like 15 years. And he was confused, like, okay, there are so many variations on what a baseball card is. There's this whole grading process. There's all these different places you can buy it from. And I'm pretty confused. So he bought this card. And then the next day he realized that he had overpaid. He wasn't even sure if it was authentic. And there were like a dozen other marketplaces he could be finding this stuff at. So in that time period, what Eric thought was like, okay, well, putting together my own personal collector passions as someone that loves cards, NFTs, sneakers, art, and then marrying that with the fact that when I was, when I was at Bloomberg, I was building like products and data to help big financial institutions make decisions around trading, buying stocks, bonds, et cetera, valuing them. He thought to himself, okay, well, what if we could create something like a Bloomberg per se for the collectible space? And if you really abstract away what Bloomberg is, it is data in the sense that a Bloomberg terminal provides you with the information, data, analytics you need to figure out like, okay, what is the price of oil right now? What should I be buying? Like making decisions around that. At the same time, Bloomberg is a media brand. You know, Bloomberg News gets people information, education they need to understand how the financial markets work. So at an abstract level, we thought, can we do that for New Street? So right now we've spent the last, I guess, year and a half collecting and gathering data on all these different collectibles, specifically starting with sneakers, trading cards, NFTs, the three areas that we consider to be honestly, in some ways, surprisingly most overlapping and also the most culturally relevant to pop culture and society. Like all the things that influence cards, sneakers, and NFTs are things like sport, fashion, music, art, et cetera. Gathering data around pricing, around product that we are then going to like expose in the form of APIs. So while we want to have the sort of intellectual rigor of a Bloomberg in terms of providing data and analysis and advice and news on these different things, we also want to have a connection to the culture, talking about the stories. Like, why does someone buy Air Jordans? It's because of the history and the cultural relevance of Michael Jordan. Why does someone buy Pokemon? Not just for financial reasons, but also for emotional reasons. But we're finding this world where people are buying and collecting and investing in passion, which of course, something you're very familiar with. So for us, we want to be the company that's at the forefront of that, starting with sneakers, cards, and NFTs.
Amazing. I mean, there are so many parallels in our market. Sure. It's like, you know, I was suspicious that there were so many parallels, but I mean, you've literally outlined exactly where the world is in terms of prints and multiples as well, because, you know, prints and multiples have that, you know, it's a passion asset, passion assets like that. I thought what was really interesting is the kind of, it seems like it's grown, but this synergy with COVID and a kind of shutdown of the world and this kind of realization. And your founder's story is really, really similar to the founders of My Art Broker in terms of being collectors themselves. Yeah. And actually, you know, quite similarly, buying a Banksy print and it not being in the condition that they thought it was in. And realizing, you know, this is not built for it's not fit for purpose. And you know, it's probably slightly different in the sneaker world, yeah. But in the art world, there's these huge institutions that sort of run the market, and yet they're not in the world where digital media,
yeah,
particularly within the passion area and transparency is so important. You know, it's not fit for purpose anymore, and it's about developing things. So tell me about the data and how you come up with fair market value for a pair of sneakers or a baseball card.
Yeah, well, that's the ideal goal. It's not like we've all figured it out so far, but essentially, if you think about it, like right now, some of the challenges around pricing and product are even just knowing where these things exist. Where can I buy sneaker X? Where can I buy this kind of baseball card? So what we've been doing for the last couple of years is basically getting as much comprehensive data around particularly price and product for these different collectibles. And we have that available right now in the next like few months. We're going to be like releasing this in the form of APIs. But the challenge is these markets are actually a lot more complicated than people think. Like maybe to draw an analogy with Banksy, for example, if I just Googled, like, let's say buy a Banksy print, you know, I mean, there's so many variations, different prices you'd find on different marketplaces. And imagine if you had kind of like a sky scanner for Banksy, perhaps, you know, that wouldn't necessarily solve what I guess fair market value is, because that could obviously fluctuate on things like cultural relevance as well. But for us, what we want to do is just bring more data and transparency and access to give tools to collectors and investors. Because right now, the level of transparency that exists is very small. I don't think we can necessarily solve it completely without working together with other companies and, you know, a longer term vision towards how to make the collectibles market more transparent. And step one for us is just purely getting the right pricing around where you can find these things, what the historical pricing has been, things like that, and then the right data around product. So what are these actual cards? What are the variations? Where can you find them?
Right. I mean, I can't tell you again how many parallels there are. Yeah. So in the Banksy market, it's actually, because obviously with prints and editions, it's a comps market, unlike original artwork. So, but actually the Banksy market is probably very similar to, you know, some of those baseball cards that you mentioned that are relatively formulaic. Like there's unsigned editions of 800, there's signed editions of 150. There are certain series that always hit a certain demand. And actually it's one of the reasons we exist, because if you take a print to auction, it has a market value. It has a fair market value. There are potentially another 800 in the market that have been moving through, unlike an original, which has, you know, one particular moment and maybe a lifetime, you know. So it's so similar. And then you have other markets like the Warhol market, which is probably more like, you know, some of your more difficult markets. So there's different modeling, and the way we've gone about it. And again, the challenges are so different, because most people work off public auction figures because they can, okay, because it's all in the public space. But the reality is that particularly since COVID, but actually well before that, most of these have been traded on the private market. So you're working with, you know, a data set, which is only really a third relevant. And I mean, there must be auction houses. And I suppose eBay, do you get a lot of data from eBay? And that's really untrustworthy, isn't it? eBay data, because do you know if it's authentic, in the same way that we have auction data that for a print that was in really bad condition, dropping the algorithm by, you know, 90% sometimes. And it's a real challenge, but it's so interesting how different people have to approach it. The way we've done it is we've taken the public data. Mm-hmm. We've blended it with our private data, which goes back 10 years. So we've been valuing prints for 10 years. We've been selling prints for 10 years. So we've got private data on what's been happening in the private market, and particularly in the Banksy market, where we've done, you know, probably the most amount of Banksy business privately in the world, which is a great thing to be able to say, and how that correlates. But what we've also done is picked up how series relate to each other. So I know nothing about baseball cards at all. And I know nothing about sneakers. I mean, I try not to know too much about NFTs, because from a kind of old fashioned art world thing, I'm still yet to be convinced. But I mean, that's actually a really interesting topic, isn't it? Like when you say, Eric approached this from also art investment, was it always NFTs, or did he also collect original artworks as well?
He actually does both. And this is the thing, like I'd like to emphasize that what we cover is like physical and digital collectibles, because I think those worlds are kind of coming together, right? So Eric has actually a lot of physical prints of artists that he's a big fan of, like actually many, many, but he also has lots of digital prints. And you find artists these days where a trend that I'm seeing a lot is this, I don't think there's an official term for this, but like kind of digital twinning, where you might have an artist who creates a physical piece of his or her work, whatever that is, and then they have like a digital version in the form of an NFT. I guess maybe in a more political, philosophical statement version, that was like the Damien Hirst, the currency is an example of that, kind of maybe the social commentary behind that. But a lot of these modern, like let's say Web3 native artists are doing both. I would say most of the artists that we see, there's a wide range of them, don't look at one at the exception of the other. Because I think that's the world that like we're living in, right? Like people will have, and putting aside NFTs for a second, we are already like, even if NFTs didn't exist, you'd still have kids around the world or just anyone spending billions of dollars on digital items and things like Fortnite, right? You still have activations from big luxury brands like Gucci in Roblox, Nike allowing you to wear Air Jordans on your Fortnite character or on like League of Legends or things like that. So to us, it's like the physical and digital divides are really blurring together.
But I guess what you're trying to trade in, I don't want to get into an argument on NFTs, but it's important. But I guess the point it becomes an NFT or a is scarcity, right? Like it's pinning it back to it being, taking something digital, which essentially could be reproduced millions of times. And I mean, look, this is the fundamental evolution of what Warhol was doing in his factory in the 1960s. So it's like a fascinating world. You know, that's why artists originally produced prints is to be able to give people access. And then the NFT is really just saying, you know, actually you can own something.
Exactly.
Which is just a concept that people find quite difficult to get their heads around, I think.
Yeah. Because you think about the ideas of like rarity and population, right? So like for example, I don't know, Warhol only did 100 variations of this one piece. There are only this number of watches in the world that are this exact model. There are only this number of baseball cards that exist for like Babe Ruth. That's why that's a big factor in the value of cards that are particularly vintage ones, is that like there are only, let's say, 10 known versions of this Babe Ruth card that was made in 1918, which is why they just keep going up in price. There's only this many sneakers that were released, like the Pigeon Dunks in 2004, which are like very well known. There's only this many NFTs. It's just that we come to this place where the blockchain allows people to actually provably say there are only 10 of these digital items. Now, mm-hmm. Of course, the industry itself of NFTs can kind of sometimes conflate that main value proposition with all the other crazy things happening in that industry, but fundamentally it's a way to prove the sort of digital scarcity. And that is a factor in the value of something. Cause like we're saying in the physical world, if we know there are only 10 of those Picasso paintings that were created, that is an element in whether something or not is valuable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what about, tell me about New Street's community. So, presumably, you know, it's just as much about access. Like you made a great analogy earlier about Bloomberg and like just giving you data. You know, like, and there's a lot of, particularly in our space, there's a lot of similar platforms that just offer data, but they don't necessarily offer connection. They don't offer the ability to see what's in demand, what's in supply. They just give you the data. So what's New Street's kind of mission around community in these particular spaces?
Yeah, I would say like from like a B2B community perspective, like our data is meant to help people who want to build in this industry, right? Like I think if you were to be building, let's say, a trading platform or a marketplace for sneakers or for NFTs that you want to start tomorrow, and we've talked to companies that are doing this kind of thing, the sort of element of you building that is actually underrated in terms of difficulty is getting the right data for that. So for example, if our friend Sally were to go say, hey, I'm really passionate about photography NFTs because I'm a photographer myself and I love that, and also photography is just important to me, and I think we should have like a marketplace that's just about selling photography NFTs. The idea is great and it makes a lot of sense, but there's an entire element of like, okay, well, where do you get the data dynamically about where those NFTs are coming from? Like maybe they're listed on 20 different marketplaces right now. Maybe someone hasn't listed them. Maybe you got to like track that data because it might change. Maybe someone sold it today, but if you have data that's old, then you might not have recorded that. So for us, there's this sort of element where what's really, really important is that we talk to people who are building things in this space, because we're not trying to build that photography marketplace. You know, we're not trying to build that sneaker marketplace that might exist. And there probably will be more that do exist. What we want to do is kind of be the back end data provider for that. So it's like the more companies we know that have an interest in that data, whether it's for an NFT photography company, maybe it's to plug into a financial model as they're trying to assess the broader space of investable collectible assets and alternative assets. It's very important that we have as many relationships like that as possible. Now, in a sort of broader big picture B2C perspective, that's kind of where like our media and community comes in, because we have people who are, let's say, builders, collectors, higher affinity individuals in this space, but also we really believe in a world where at a certain point in the future, everyone in the world should have the opportunity to invest in like passion and culture. And I think that's kind of an empowering message, because if you think about how gatekeeping existed throughout traditional financial markets, I mean, to invest in a stock like 40 years ago, you had to like know a broker and call someone. You probably weren't from a non-privileged background in a lot of different ways. But today we're getting to the point where people are able to invest in things like, let's say, a baseball card or a basketball card. And if you're a really big fan of basketball and you know that this like rookie player is underrated because he maybe isn't being covered that well, you're a big basketball fan, you can actually make a bet and profit off the fact that you're a fan of that person and he might be a more valuable asset moving forward. Now, for us, making that group of people as big as possible is obviously good for us because we have more people who are collectors, investors, but it's also good for anyone in this industry, right? The more we can get the behavior and mentality for people to actually understand that, hey, you can actually buy sneakers as a reflection of culture. You can collect things like Pokemon cards as a reflection of culture. That's important to us. Now, the biggest thing, I think, barrier right now to that is really education, right? So what we do here with the podcast and with newsletters and creating articles is teaching people about how this stuff works. Because like I said, I might be a 16-year-old fan of Ronaldo. And if I Google buy Ronaldo football cards, there's really no easy onboarding process to that. You're probably going to get, if not scammed, you'll make a decision that's overwhelmingly confusing, or maybe just get ripped off in some way or make the wrong decision. So for us, there's like a B2B community element of getting to know founders and technologists in this space, but also how do we create like a community that educates people about the space in general, that's bigger and worldwide. And that community is growing no matter whether we exist or not, to be honest.
Oh my God, fascinating. And so similar. You should get into the prints market.
For sure.
Talk about the algorithm and the product and the tech behind it for hours and hours. So what is happening in the baseball card market at the moment? What did COVID do to it? You know, I'm sure there's, you know, so I was, we, you know, refer back to the banks market in the pandemic, like it went boom. I mean, you know, it's now had to correct itself because they were the most, that people were trading them like chips. So tell me what happened in COVID to these three markets. I mean, I think I know what happened to NFTs, but let's talk about that. What should one be looking at in some of these markets at the moment?
Okay. Hold me back if I talk for more than 5 hours, because like we could just have like hour long deep dives on each sub segment of the market. But let me start like macro and get slightly more specific as time goes by. Well, I mean, if you look at COVID, right, there were a lot of behaviors that we turn to as like modern society, like let's say the rise in e-commerce, the rise in things like people spending more time inside and maybe spending their money not on things like restaurants outside or physical events. And one of the beneficiaries of that were these collectibles, where even actually prior to, let's say, NFTs and stuff, you saw things like GameStop and Wall Street Bets. People were just like investing in stocks that were kind of meme stocks. And that was also probably related to Robinhood and the fact that particularly in the US, people were, the friction to investing and collecting went down through things like Robinhood. So that there was this sort of whole cultural movement towards more retail investing. And as people started thinking, okay, well, what do I spend my money on? You know, apart from buying Tesla or Dogecoin or shorting GameStop, people started getting back into things like baseball cards and Pokemon cards, because there was this sort of inflection point where I'd say 2021, 2020, more so 2021, there was this sort of like coming of age of people that were driven by nostalgia. And you saw this huge boost in the card market specifically, where baseball cards, football cards, basketball cards all start going up in terms of like average price. And this is the thing too, whenever we talk about this, there's so many different variations here and like nuances, but let's just speak overly simplistically broad. The card market started going up, there was more interest in it. And the same thing happened for sneakers, the same thing happened for cards. People got to the, sorry, for NFTs, which is for a slightly different reason. But people got to this point where they realized that, okay, the things that I wanted to buy maybe as a kid, let's say a baseball card or an Air Jordan shoe, one shoe, which isn't always cheap, they had the income to buy these things now, maybe people in their like early 30s, for example. And that was kind of an interesting target market that started growing during COVID. Now, as time went on, we saw that these things grew in like specific ways that go beyond the macro level. So NFTs, I think, were a function of the fact that people found digital collectibles a more understandable and palatable way to figure out things like crypto and Web3 and the blockchain. It was a way to kind of attach yourself to a community. A lot of it was very much driven by like hype and culture. That's not too dissimilar from a brand like Supreme or streetwear brands in general. That same cultural underlying layer existed for sneakers as well, as people just start getting really hyped about things like, let's say, Travis Scott releases. And for cards as well, it just became a more common like hobby in terms of where people put their money. Also pair that with stimulus checks, particularly in the US at that time. So you had this point where like in 2021, all these different industries are really exploding. I would say as time went on, in 2022, like the market started coming down for a variety of like macroeconomic reasons as well. Arguably, you could say that 2021's market was very much hyped and that it wouldn't last forever. But now you're getting to this point where, I mean, we're still in a situation where we believe in the long-term future, just like how the dot-com bubble didn't mean the internet was bullshit. We still think the same thing with collectibles, where a lot of the companies that have survived or have thrived are the ones that you want to keep your eye on. A lot of the NFT projects that have stuck around are the ones you want to keep your eye on. A lot of them have gone away, but that's like at a high level. I'm happy to dive into specifics, honestly, by sport and NFT or sneakers. Seriously.
It's really, really interesting. And also it's sort of a bit of an eye opener for me because what we experienced during that time was bank street art particularly, and Banksy in particular, you know, really, and then there was a correction. But actually what it's done to that market, whilst at the moment American pop is absolutely booming, what it's done to that market is the signed prints, the more rare signed prints, you have not lost value on. It was the, what we saw was the memorabilia part of this market, the stuff that we don't trade in, was going through the roof. And then that was pushing up the unsigned value of prints. The top level has you know, hasn't really seen, it never needed to correct, there's been a correction, which, you know, it's just classic. It's just so interesting that it's all connected. And, you know, and it's access and it's data. And again, like the simplicity of data, you know, it is a lot more complicated to talk about some of the rarer prints that have, you know, to have less than like 5 data points in the last 10 years. And this is still part of the challenge, is looking, we have to look across series within the algorithm in order to inform the algorithm, because actually you can't just take private and public sales data and run it through, you know, a varying kind of repeat sales regression technology. You have to look outside of that, and then that factor of community, which is where this conversation started, really starts becoming important, because the ability to so our site works like a trading platform in the background. So it's essentially picking up our network and the supply and demand of our network and showing it to our clients. So at any one time, people can see that there's 5 available of this, there's 28 within our network, you know, and there's maybe, you know, 20 people that want it right now. I mean, you know, the kind of personal element comes when you start negotiating on price and you speak to one of our salespeople and you go through the specialism, which is ideally for us what it's all about. It's about connecting that specialism with that market data and that tech, which brings me back to this word collect tech, which I love. And I think I saw on your site, is this a term that's been around for ages, collect tech? I love to, they take the T, by the way, clearly, just to make people understand, take the T, collect, and they turn it into tech. Is this like a buzzword that I just haven't been aware of?
I'd like to think that we deserve a good chunk of credit for beginning to popularize that, not exclusively, of course. I think this is a term that will become more and more common as time goes on. And we're actually in the process, we're hosting an event in May called the Collect Tech Summit, and really want to build this to be a thing, because, I mean, some of these things that you kind of take for granted, like fintech, for example, that wasn't always a thing. If you said fintech 20 years, like maybe 30 years ago, they're like, what do you mean? And the creation of these, like, I guess, industry terms and subsequently industry bodies, those were sometimes conscious decisions by companies and organizations that needed to come together. So what's really important for us is to make Collect Tech a thing and try to create, like, one of our plans is to make a Collect Tech consortium, get people from across the industry, because I think conceptually, sometimes people don't realize how connected these things are. It's like, if you work in like what you're doing or what I'm doing, you might realize, okay, well, there's market dynamics here that are very similar. But if you from afar have never bought a card, if you've never bought sneakers, never bought art, you might think about these things as completely, completely different. But as time goes on, you see that they're actually not. And you, and then there's even bigger things happening, like Nike buying Artifact, you know, the NFT fashion brand, sneaker brand. And now Nike is launching many digital products in coordination with their physical products. 2 years ago, that sounded insane. Like, literally, the idea of Nike launching NFTs sounded absolutely insane 2 years ago. But then towards the end of 2021, when they bought Artifact, I think that changed the game in a lot of ways. Now, every sneaker company, every shoe brand wants to talk about their Web3 strategy. And they all have pretty much done their own versions to varying degrees of success of NFT drops. Apply that same thing to fashion. I can name dozens of examples. Apply that same thing to many, many other companies. We're still definitely early, and not all these executions are good. Let's be very clear about that. But it's hurtling in the direction that we think is the marriage of physical and digital, because our lives are becoming more and more physical and digital.
So interesting. And what you're saying about Collect Tech is really interesting as well, because there's this like well-known adage in the art world where people love to, like, you take kind of a bricks and mortar gallery, and then it's like, we're entering the art tech space. And it's like, no, you're not allowed to just have a website and call yourself art tech, which is, you know, still something that happens. So first of all, like, how much does this is like someone asking me how much a Banksy print goes for, but how much does a baseball card go for? Like, what's the average market value? Where do I start? Like, how much cash do I need to have? And considering they're now fractionalizing them, they must be worth a great deal.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give you an answer that is probably intentionally, just because of the reality, complicated. You can buy some baseball cards literally in like bargain bins at stores for cents. Right. For reference, the most expensive baseball card ever sold, I believe, was last year for $12 million.
Okay.
A Mickey Mantle card. And maybe similar to the art market, what we're seeing on the higher end, just as an observation on the higher end of the market, it's kind of recession proof, right? Like the records that are broken for like most expensive basketball card, most expensive baseball card, those records are broken every single year. And I doubt, no matter how bad like the economy is, someone's going to go from buying like the most expensive baseball card or basketball card or whatever from like $8 million to $10 million to 12 to 14, whatever. Obviously not financial advice, nor am I a financial truth fortune teller. But that's something we've seen if you look back at it historically.
And when that baseball card went for 12 million, where did it sell?
I think it was these happen on one of the big, so there's this traditional, like, let's say Sotheby's and Christie's, there's a lot of sales of this stuff sometimes across sneakers, cards, and NFTs. But also in the more sort of traditional collectible world, there are a lot of these big auction houses that are like Golden Auctions, PWCC, Heritage Auctions. They're all usually based in the US, and they're the ones that do things like, let's say, sell record breaking, like, let's say there was a Kobe Bryant jersey that was game worn that sold for a few million like last week, I think. So you have this Sotheby's, Christie's, perhaps Phillips, things like that, that are getting into this stuff. Then you have the world of sports related memorabilia. You generally might find like comic books sold from these companies, like Golden Auctions, Heritage Auctions. And it's a crazy, crazy world, but it keeps going. Now,
did that 12, what was the trajectory of that £12 million baseball card? Like, did we see it, what was it bought for? Like, you know, this, like, just to equate it, like some of the Banksy prints now were bought for 150 quid on a Banksy on a Bristol market stall. You know, so where does and how, you know, if I had £5,000 to spend now, where should I put my money? And how would New Street tell me that, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so let me answer that in two parts. One, referencing the specific higher end items, and two, giving advice to the person, obviously not financial advice. So firstly, so a lot of these like vintage cards are generally from some of the best athletes of all time. So for example, you might find like Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, those baseball cards. They're players who are playing in like the 50s, for example. And at the time, you probably could buy one of their baseball cards. If we were like younger in the 50s, we could buy it for like maybe cents on the dollar, maybe dollars. Sometimes, like if you look back at the history of baseball cards, sometimes these cards were in like cigarette packs. And there's like an interesting history around that. Now, the reason that these have maintained their value is a mixture of things. One, Babe Ruth, for example, is considered one of the greatest baseball players of all time. His legacy just continues to get bigger and bigger each year that goes by. So subsequently, the value of his items, whether you want to buy like a Babe Ruth jersey or a card, generally increases in value. Now, another element of that is scarcity. So sometimes these cards, there's like stories, and I don't remember some of the specifics, but like some of the stories are like, okay, there are only 10 of these printed, or like 500 of these printed. And then there was like a fire, and then now there are only like 5 in known existence. And each of these, like in the official population data, there are only 5 of these that exist. So there's an element of rarity and scarcity that comes from these cards, and they've been tracked for decades, right? So let's say a card might have been produced in 1954, but we know that each year that gone by, there's only this many left in the world. Now, on top of that, there's a grading element to it too. So baseball cards and all sports and TCG cards generally have this element where one of the major grading companies, like let's say PSA or Beckett, they grade a card, it's like quality from like a 0 to a 1 to a 10. And the cards that have the highest grade, that have the lowest population and cover and are of like some of the most famous people, athletes of all time, are generally the ones that sell for that much. And the price has generally been going up and up historically, because no matter what happens, there won't be more of these cards produced.
Yep.
Unless some brand new athlete completely destroys all records forever, there probably won't be someone that crushes that person's record. And because we know that not many others will ever be produced again, then you have the situation where it's like, okay, well, if there's only 2 grade 10s in existence, then that, like, the value of that rarity and scarcity just increases over time. Mm-hmm. Now, what we're talking about are markets for very wealthy individuals. Like, probably most people don't have the ability to bid on like a $5 million basketball card. As you go down, use that same criteria, you can look at things right now that might be investments at the lower end. So I think what's interesting, particularly about cards, and by the way, how this works sometimes has an analogy with NFT or sneaker, but I'm going to focus on sports cards at this exact moment. So let's just take the NBA. Generally speaking, your investment, your collection of a particular player is in many ways a bet on their career. So let's say you might bet quote unquote by buying cards of a particular rookie because you think he's undervalued. And you think that by the time he retires, maybe he's only been playing in the NBA for a year, you think that he's going to win 10 championships, break all these records. Now, because that is some of the calculus that goes into making a decision, you also need to figure out like, okay, well, Topps or Panini launched this person's rookie cards. And generally the rookie cards, which are the earliest, are the most valuable on average. Mm-hmm. You can see like, okay, but they've launched like 20,000 of these cards, or there's only 5 that are graded 10 though. So you have to think about, okay, Luka Doncic is a good example, or Zion Williamson. These are both young NBA players who are considered already very, very good and potentially could become legends, but they have sometimes hundreds or thousands of variations of their card. So it's a slightly more diluted situation. And that's a big topic in the card market, like dilution and oversupply, where sure, even if Luka becomes the best player of all time, the fact that there's 20,000 of his cards available right now means that you'll never have the same sort of scarcity as a Babe Ruth that was made in 1925 or whatever. So to me, I think like a smart decision to make is be diversified, right? As any sort of person would tell you in finances, right? Don't just buy, but maybe. Also where collectibles aren't just about finances, right? Like I might buy cards for Luka Doncic because I love him as a player. I might be, he plays for the Dallas Mavericks and maybe I'm from Dallas. And to me, no matter how well this guy does, I am a diehard Dallas Mavericks fan.
Yeah.
And so that in one ways might result in a good ROI for me in the long term, or I might just keep that for the rest of my life and give it to my grandkids. So it's interesting. Like I've interviewed a lot of people on our podcast who are diehard baseball fan collectors, baseball collectors. And sometimes the calculus is purely financial. Sometimes the calculus is purely emotional. So mm-hmm. I'd say, honestly, if you're interested in figuring out like, what do you care about? What like, do you follow sports? Do you like Pokemon? Do you like, I don't know, whatever you're interested in, I would say maybe the investment advice, quote unquote, is similar to perhaps how you'd suggest that for buying art, right?
You love and try and get something that's in low supply. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, honestly, you could have picked up every time you mentioned a baseball player's name and put an artist.
Yeah, exactly, right?
If they're dead, it helps because the supply is stopped. And there are amazing printmakers at the moment who are producing a huge amount of art, they probably are going to hit the secondary market. Yeah. But because of the supply, you know, it's just ongoing and it's ongoing. And also, I think, you know, with the terrain of NFTs being part of it, you know, and Damien Hirst loves playing with this. You know, to give him credit, he plays with it brilliantly. I mean, you know, poor people that lose out. But it's a bit like you said earlier, there are some things that the artists are doing at the moment, which you wouldn't, like 2 years ago would have been like, no, that's ridiculous. No, that's not going to work. And now it's like, yeah, actually that totally works. And again, like you talking about scarcity is exactly the same in the art market. And also it really reminds me of, so my background is Christie's Auction House. And back in like 2012, we used to run the pop culture sale. And a sale also called Out of the Ordinary. And I've just realized, these sales have kind of dissolved into specialist handbag sales, specialist online platforms that exactly like you run. And back then it was everything that has turned into now these little fanatical groups of collectors. And now they're full of the Out of the Ordinary sale, for instance, you know, you'd have James Bond's trunks Swarovski encrusted dog skeleton, a piece of wedding cake from like the Queen's wedding that's like completely moldy but kept in perfect condition. And that's kind of what's left. It's become like the weird and the wonderful because these actually investable markets where there are comparables, and that's the key, right? There's not anything that used to be in pop culture that in the pop culture category or auctions that has comparables and is a big enough market space because of the use of digital and because of the use of being able to connect with people digitally from around the world. There's this whole community out there, which is not the same for the weird and the wonderful when you're talking about, you know, unusual. I'm sure somebody's going to say there is, but some kind of weird taxidermy.
Rally Road is like a fractional investment platform for alternative assets, and they talk about selling like dinosaur bones and stuff like that. Yeah, you know,
there's another company called A Showpiece that does the same. Yeah. Does the same thing, and also that's become like the norm, right? The concept of being able to. So for me, I find that quite difficult to come to terms with because if I'm going to own a Warhol, I want it on my wall. I know that's the reason why it works is because some people just can afford a small share of it. It's kind of the jar of it. But then again, you know, in the NFT world, people don't display them. Do people display baseball cards? Is there a way to display baseball cards?
Yeah, there is a way to display baseball cards. Whether it's in a very big ornate display case, if you wish, or something just more informally, I don't know, holding it into like a binder. And also just give a shout out to some NFT companies that I'm a big fan of. There are like digital display like panels where people have, let's say, their NFT sitting in their living room, and it's just might be like, let's say, an interactive piece. So it keeps like looping. Infinite Objects is a great company that does that. We're close to them. And I think it's there's so much to talk about here. I mean, I'd like to think as well that my dream for, let's say, 5 years from now, because I think you touched on a really good point that seems to be a challenge across art and all the collectibles that I've been talking about, is I'd like to think like 5 years from now, if I type in whatever search platform we're using or however this ends up happening, like what is the price for Banksy prints? Like, how could I buy Luka Doncic cards? How could I buy like Air Jordan ones? There's actually data that tells you what you need to know. Because right now, if you enter those queries onto Google, sure, you might have some articles that are like, hey, here is a variation on some. Hey, buy some right here. Hey, here's like a recent price, a big sale that happened on Christie's or whatever. That doesn't answer your question. That doesn't answer like, what should you be buying? What's the difference? Okay, like what should I be thinking about in terms of like comparables, et cetera? Right now, that doesn't exist. What we're building and everybody else who's interested in this is ideally like a way to make that future a reality. And we know that we're just one piece of that puzzle. We're not the whole thing, but we want to work with people to make that happen as part of like a broader collect tech vision.
And so the idea is eventually is that you'll be able to pick up every comps market,
yeah,
and be able to use the same background technology to, yeah, right. And that is that by how wide is your data?
Yeah.
Are you scraping data from like a vast amount of like everything from eBay to auctions? Yeah. Like, how are you, is everywhere?
All of the above. Yeah. Wow. Which is why, like, as you probably know, it's not like something you can just snap your fingers and do. Like, there's elements to it too. It's like data acquisition is a full-time job for teams, you know, a full-time job for a single company. Then you have things like cleaning the data, organizing the data, sorting the
data.
And
it has to be done manually. There's stuff that you can't do without someone sitting there being like, I know that particular print isn't actually that particular print, especially if the data going in, which I imagine with eBay, you have a terrible, so authenticity, so we don't use any data that isn't from an authentic source, but you must have a nightmare using eBay data to inform.
This is a daily challenge for the part of the business that thankfully I'm not involved in that day to day, in the sense that cleaning the data, making sure we have accurate data, acquiring it, that's done by like our CTO and our data science team. But yes, it is an ongoing challenge that won't necessarily just be solved when we launch and we'll have zero problems and zero issues with it. It's an ongoing thing that I think will be a big part of business no matter what happens, right? So the data acquisition piece, like, and maybe new categories will come in that we want to add, right? Like, I go back to the card piece, I think, at the beginning, because that is particularly messy in terms of like different variables that don't exist across things. Like, you don't grade sneakers. That might happen in the future, but there's no like sort of grading company to figure out sneaker variations. You also don't have the same number of variations for sneakers or NFTs as you do cards. Sometimes there could be like literally hundreds or thousands of variations of the same card. And that's just insane to me sometimes. So as we think about these things, like let's say we get into watches next, or wine, or comic books, there might be elements of those particular markets that I don't even know will cause an element of complication, but that's going to be our long-term challenge, try to solve those data problems no matter what happens in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, I suppose using three categories at the moment that you're focusing on that are quite so, I can't even imagine what the condition issues with, like, how do you solve? Because, you know, we see that a lot. Like, that's why you get these really difficult valuations where, you know, you've got a trajectory within a series that is going up beautifully, showing you a beautiful line. And then there's one print that you're like, that must be an outlier. And manually, we have a team that goes through and look for those outliers. Yeah. And then you realize it's not an outlier. It's just something that was in such bad condition. Or, which I imagine you have a problem with more so because you're using so many different sources, not to be pointing out problems, I'm just trying to illustrate how complex it is. You know, that actually it is the print, but it went through a particularly bad auction house and so therefore didn't command what it should have commanded. I mean, you must see that a lot. I suppose condition with sneakers is also really important. People don't necessarily buy them to wear, right?
Depending,
they buy them to store them and display them.
It depends. And this is the thing, like sometimes the answers to these questions are like yes and no. So I mean, and this is the reason why, like, we want to work with all these different companies. Like, we want to build a relationship with everybody from eBay to StockX to the biggest like NFT marketplaces like OpenSea, because these challenges are mutually beneficial, right? Like, if we know that we can work with eBay and say, hey, like, here's a better way to think about data, then that just helps their business. We're not here trying to sell anything, to be honest, right? Like, we're not a marketplace ourselves. We benefit from all marketplaces growing. And I think too, it's like, it's interesting, like, in a way, the grading element of cards, if it's not a raw card, which is, again, terminology here, raw card means it's ungraded, but the grading element of cards is actually, and sometimes a good thing, because I don't think paintings aren't graded, right? Art isn't graded where the quality or condition, right?
They're not, but I mean, the conversation of like grading the prints market is something that, you know, and it always feels like that step too far. You know, because ultimately you're dealing with a passion asset and it's, you can't really grade it. You can't. I mean, you could definitely build something that's similar to a grading system. Sure.
Well, we've seen grading companies that are like full-blown startups that have raised venture funding that just purely talk about grading. And they use things like, let's say, AI to do a better job of like grading a card, grading a comic book, et cetera. So that, again, that's like another world where we're not trying to be a grading company at all, but should we work with them to help solve these problems? Like, hell yes. We'd like to be like partners with all these different people. And that's just one example. So there's so many different elements and nuances that we realize we can't do on our own, which is why we're trying to build a sort of collect tech consortium, which is like a really big focus for us.
I think the other thing around the grading concepts, it comes back to that conversation you have with a client or somebody looking to invest for the first time. And ultimately, they're asking for grading conversations. They're asking for something that says, and then that always leads into appetite for risk. Okay, because there's obviously there's obviously artists. First of all, if you're really up for risk and you're purely buying on passion, go to the primary market, because you can make really big mistakes and you can really love it, which, you know, primary galleries hate me saying, but it's true. Like the chances of you buying something on the primary market and being able to return what you spent are pretty much zero. The chances of you buying something on the secondary market with a 5-year, 10-year, 20-year, 50-year pricing record is that you will return your money. It depends, you know, how liquid that is, depends what you buy. And the and essentially like a grading system comes down to your appetite for risk, right? So if you want to buy into something, you know, the people that bought into the Banksy market very, very early on, they were not thinking about risk. Right. They were thinking about, that's cool.
Yeah.
And what's great about this market is that there's a lot of people who bought them not, you know, the chances of them buying something at the Bristol Street Market that might have been worth something, and they weren't treated. And I imagine this is the same for very rare sneakers and those very early baseball cards. They weren't treated like pieces of they weren't treated like assets, so people didn't care about them. They literally stuck them up, they shoved them under the bed. Some people don't even realize what they've got. Then they've got to go down authenticity and get a pest control certificate, and then they're just shocked and amazed at the fact that they might have something real. And you know, it can make a huge difference to someone's life, you know, like realizing that you've got a genuine Banksy. But you know, there's when we come back to grading, if you're entering this market knowing that there's a secondary value for something, there are artists that you would invest in that are very particular to how long you're hoping to hold it, you know. And at the height of the market in 2020, and you probably had exactly the same, you know, towards the end of 2020, early 21, we had exactly what you're talking about. The financial audience went sky high, but all they're really interested in is, what can I get at a good price? You know, what can I get now? What can I get now that's at a good price? The ones that, and the other side of our database, as it sounds the same with you, is people who they're buying for passion. Their risk doesn't really come into it, which is why grading doesn't really work. They're buying for passion, but they're also just sensible about their investment. And the reality is, if you buy a Warhol print or a Lichtenstein print or a Keith Haring print, and you buy it from a reputable source, you will not lose money. So it's the perfect investment. If you love it, what could be better?
Well, this is the thing where we are very, very intentional about the fact that we're not just purely like a financial platform where it's like, okay, here's the ROI on this Pokemon card. We also are very much open to the fact that someone might just love Pokemon, right? And I think that those worlds can coexist. And in fact, they overlap a lot of time. Maybe as a collector, I might be, I'm just a diehard fan of the Philadelphia Eagles. So I will buy any merchandise, no matter what price it is. I'll buy any cards from the Philadelphia Eagles. But when we talk about basketball, I am basically a gambler. I am an investor. I will only go for basketball cards that have gone through my own rigorous analysis, and whether that's a better investment for me than wherever else I'm putting my money. And I think that makes sense, right? We treat these things differently. Like, you might talk to people that are looking at art as purely an investment. You might talk to others as being big fans of some sort of artistic movement. And I think that's honestly the way the world is always going to be. It's never going to be one at the expense of the other. And what we're mindful of in particular is the fact that no matter whether you are someone buying a quote unquote, let's say a Pokemon card because you love it, maybe you're buying it for a friend, you know, that Pokemon is what they love, or an investment, we respect both of those behaviors equally. And not just that, but you'll need like data, you'll need media, you'll need education no matter who you are. Mm-hmm. It's helpful for you to make a better decision to just have like what we're trying to provide, no matter what your outcome is. And I think that's where we want to really be a tool for any collector or investor, no matter who you are.
That's, and I think that's like the perfect roundup, because You've literally just hit it on the head, which is around, it's around decision making, isn't it? Yeah. Like it is, it's around, you know, our mission as a company changed over the last 3 years. And it, we started off, you know, facilitating sales, buyer, seller, facilitate. You will get a better deal if you work with my art broker. Yeah. You will, because we're built in order not to need to charge people as much. We, you know, we're an online business. We're in, particularly in the art world, we're incredibly agile, which isn't very difficult to be more agile than the rest of the art world. But, you know, it's built for that. And that's the USP. These days, it's around giving people information. It's around, you know, I hate using the word education because actually many of our clients are so much more educated than I am about what they're buying. But what they don't have is the data that they need at their fingertips. So it doesn't matter if you're buying for passion. It doesn't matter if you're buying for finance. It doesn't matter if you're buying for your wife's birthday, which is coming up in September. So you really need that print delivered on this date because she's been looking at it for the last 12 years. And now is the time that one's available at the price that you were looking for it at. But the point is that you have that information and it's not this completely confusing world that starts with a Google search and ends in like, okay, okay, I'll bid up to that amount on eBay. Yeah. And then I guess it doesn't really matter if it's not real, right?
Yeah.
That's where you end. So yeah, I mean, it's just been so, so fascinating. Anthony, thank you so much. We could talk for hours and I'm sure that there is, once you're, is it an app that's going to launch then? Is there an app coming out?
There's a B2C app that is in development, but that's still kind of no specifics on timelines or development on that right now. But
what should we look out for is the next new stream?
I would say if you're like a business trying to build in the collectible space that would most likely need data in the form of like our APIs, we'd open to any discussion around that. And also, as we build out our media, we've got a newsletter that I would love people to subscribe to. We've got our own podcast. I think follow us on Twitter. And anyone who wants to collaborate on things like content, just community building on with New Street, reach out to us through any of the above channels or reach out to me personally.
Great. Amazing. Anthony, thank you so much.
Thank you, Charlotte.